And council. We don't get Mr. Zinner today.
No. Unfortunately, he's no longer with our office.
Oh, Chad, me.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Koch here on behalf of Mr. Navarro. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. Okay. It's my intention, subject, of course, to the court's preferences, to begin with the corpus delicti issue and then move on to the public trial issue. We're asking this court to find that the state failed to present sufficient evidence independent of Mr. Navarro's admissions to prove the corpus delicti of trafficking and stolen property. Our argument depends largely and rests largely on the Supreme Court's decision in State v. Brockup, which remains the most recent and comprehensive discussion of what corpus delicti actually requires in a particular case. We know from that case that we need prima facie corroboration of the crime that's described in the defendant's statement. It's not just any crime that's out there. We also know that prima facie means independent evidence that supports a logical and reasonable inference of the facts to be proved. Now, there were three defendants in Brockup, and Mr. Navarro's case, I think, is most like Mr. Brockup's case. Specifically, Mr. Brockup was charged with possession of ephedrine with intent to manufacture methamphetamine. He was caught stealing something like 15 to 30 packs of Sudafed. When he was stopped, he admitted that ultimately the purpose for this was to make methamphetamine. Clearly, there was evidence independent of his statements that he had stolen the ephedrine and that he possessed the ephedrine, but the Supreme Court required more. They required prima facie evidence that he intended to manufacture meth outside of what he admitted to, and there was no evidence of that in the case, despite the fact that he had clearly stolen the ephedrine and clearly possessed more than the law allows. I think similarly in Mr. Navarro's case, he was charged with trafficking and stolen property in the first degree. That requires the defendant knowingly traffics in stolen property. And of course, traffics has a specific definition that requires that he distribute or transfer the stolen property or possess it with the intent to do so. Now, there's no doubt that separate from Mr. Navarro's statements, there's evidence that he possessed stolen property. Clearly, he did. They found it in his own home. But just like in Brockup, there is not independent evidence showing the particular crime at issue here, trafficking, because there's no evidence showing that he, in fact, intended to ultimately sell the property that he had or that he already sold some stolen property. All the evidence shows is that about 19 days after a burglary, he was in possession of stolen property in his home. Now, the state points to the particular characteristics of the property that was found. It notes, for example, that the cameras and the other things were of value, and therefore it's reasonable to conclude that he intended to sell these. That's not the only reasonable conclusion, though. You can certainly turn that around and say, because this is valuable equipment, it's something that Mr. Navarro would have wanted to keep for himself.
Is that the test, that there are multiple reasonable inferences, or does the state satisfy the rule when it presents evidence from which a reasonable inference is possible?
Well, first of all, it has to be a reasonable inference.
Okay.
You have to get there, and I think it's not. Simply because somebody possesses something that's of value, it's not a reasonable inference to conclude that they intend to sell it. But...
Well, you would agree that one could conclude that his method of possessing these things was inconsistent with devoting them to his personal use.
I wouldn't concede that. It's in his home. It's in a particular room. It's with a bunch of other junk, none of which is identified as stolen. It's just the property that's taken from the heir's residence. I don't think you can make any particular conclusion that just because the property was kept in a certain manner, a sloppy manner, that he intended to sell it.
Separate room from everything else, not easily accessible, and more than one of some of these things.
Well, it's stolen. I mean, so there'd be a reason, I think, maybe to keep it from other people from seeing it. But let's assume that the state has come up with one reasonable inference from the nature of how the property was kept. We know under Ayton if there's also a sort of non-criminal inference, another reason that doesn't point to the crime that they're trying to prove, then you don't get there. You haven't established the corpus delicti. So I think that gets them here, too. And the rest of their arguments are sort of along those same lines. Why would somebody keep two cameras that are similar? Well, you know, the heirs kept two cameras that were similar. Maybe he's maybe he wants to go into photography. It's better to have two similar cameras because the parts are interchangeable.
So is it your argument that as long as there's an innocent explanation for these facts, if they are insufficient to establish the prima facie rule required for the prima facie case required for corpus delicti rule?
Our argument is that they have not shown a logical and reasonable inference from the circumstances of this case. But even if they have, there is also an equally logical and reasonable inference that is not of the criminal nature that they're suggesting. And under Ayton, I think they also lose for that reason. So it's both. Now, turning, unless the court has any other questions about that issue, I do want to touch on the public trial issue as well. You know, this is not a new issue for this court. You've seen it. I know my office has raised it many times, and it has been our position and remains our position that it's well established that the right to public trial includes jury selection, all aspects of jury selection, whether it's questioning of the jurors or doing peremptory challenges or for-cause challenges or even picking the alternate jurors, which Jones seems to agree with. And the state seemed to want to carve out an exception when it comes to which particular attorney used a peremptory challenge against a particular juror. That's what they're trying to do in Mr. Navarro's case. Now, if this court doesn't already believe that public trial rights cover...
Well, what's missing? Is it that the clerk did not follow the judge's intent and record in the minutes who made the challenge, or is it that the challenges couldn't be heard by the people sitting in row four?
What's missing is any indication, either oral or written, in the courtroom or afterwards, as to which attorneys used peremptory challenges against which jurors.
That's what made it a closure.
That's what violated the right to public trial.
So, well, that's what made it. I'm wondering whether it's a closure. So that's what made it a closure. So could the clerk have done that at sentencing before the judge signed off on the final judgment and sentence, and the clerk is still in charge of the record? Could she at sentencing have put in the minutes who made the challenges and thus making it what once was a closure? It turns
not
out it wasn't a closure at all.
I think it would depend on the timing of sentencing. Sentencing is usually down the road a ways.
Yeah, it's down the road.
And so I would argue
The court's still in charge and the clerk is still in charge of the record.
That does not reopen the proceedings.
Well, it's not reopening it.
It doesn't fix the violation of the public trial right.
Well, but it was closed because it wasn't recorded immediately. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Or close in time, at least. I think, you know, when you look at the public, if you look at the public trial right, the benefit is that you've got real time, the public watching what's happening, so that the parties will act in a particular way.
Which happened here.
Except when it comes to which party was excusing which potential jurors.
Well, they were able to watch it. They weren't able to hear it.
They were able to watch. Remember, the judge here specifically went out of her way to say that I'm not going to let anyone know which attorneys are getting rid of which particular jurors, okay?
Right. No, we have a record.
Right.
We have a record of two being excused, and then there's the thing, and then two more were excused. We have that on the verbatim.
So there's no indication as to which attorney did that, even if you're sitting in the courtroom.
If there was the indication, would there then not be a closure? For example, if both of them had written them down on a piece of paper and it was filed?
Well, we have argued no. This court has disagreed.
I think Judge Dwyer wants to. What is the
certainly. The closure is that information was never available to anyone.
But
it was impossible for the public to tell. If it's filed, okay, let's say at the time it happens, then I suspect this court would find that it's not a closure because it's then available to the public. They can then look and see which attorney got rid of which juror, and there's some oversight then to make sure that they're not getting rid of jurors for the color of their skin or for their gender.
We'll
That's
back.
What's missing in this
we'll
case. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Grace Wiener with King County, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Washington. This court should rule that the trial court properly found that the state produced sufficient evidence to satisfy the corpus delicti rule and that Navarro's public trial rights were upheld by the peremptory challenge process used. And therefore, this court should affirm Navarro's conviction for trafficking in stolen property in the second degree. With respect to the corpus delicti issue, whether this court applies the higher standard set forth in Brockup that the state has to produce sufficient evidence that supports the inference, a logical and reasonable inference, that the specific crime charged, that we have sufficient evidence that this to support the specific crime charged, or the more traditional understanding that a crime was committed, the state can meet both standards. The state does not only rely on the fact that Navarro had valuable items in the in his possession that were taken from the heir's family home. It's also important to look at the location of these items. They were in a room that was attached to the home. However, you had to go into a separate entrance to get into that room. Furthermore, the room itself was very chaotic. It was messy. The officers indeed testified they had to actually move a futon out of the room in order to maneuver in that room.
Why does chaos demonstrate intent to sell?
Because it shows the condition of the room and indeed the fact that there was not
My wife describes our garage that way.
Yes, Your Honor.
Stolen property.
Yes, Your Honor. But
so how does I don't understand that argument.
Because it implies that there's looking at it in a light most favorable to the state and taking a reasonable inference from that, a reasonable inference can be drawn that it's not for his personal use. This was a room that not only contained the items from the heir's family home, again, valuable, marketable information or possessions, but also other stolen property from another individual, a Social Security card of Betty Gordon. The combination of stolen property from different individuals, frankly, it implies that there's more going on here, that there is a larger criminal operation at hand. Additionally, to Your Honor's earlier question to counsel, Judge Leach, with respect to the fact that there were a multiplicity of items, in this instance there were two cameras that were nearly identical. Moreover, the pills, the medication that was stolen from the heir's family home were found in the trash can in that room, implying that because that is not an item that could be, for example, trafficked, dispensed, disposed of, sold, that it had no use to him. So it's not only the type of items that were in the home, but the fact that there were identical items. I would note also that on those cameras, there were no pictures of from Mr. Navarro. The pictures still had the heir's family photos. They confirmed that at trial and talked about the fact that they saw their photos on there. I think it's also, looking at this in a light most favorable to the state, I think it's also important to note the items that weren't there that were taken from the heir's family home, computers, laptops, iPads, cell phones, iPod, extremely marketable items, items that are frequently trafficked, and that could also lead to an inference that that those items had already been sold, dispensed, and transferred. So in a light most favorable to the state, these factors indicate that the property was not for personal use and that it was indeed to be trafficked. Moving to the public, unless there's any further questions on that front, moving to the public trial issue, the peremptory challenge process used in this case upheld Mr. Navarro's public trial right. The record here does not support Navarro's claim that a closure occurred. The voir dire happened in open court. The piece of paper that was passed back and forth.
Why shouldn't it be an expectation that the paper exchange showing who has requested the exclusion of the jurors be made part of the permanent public record?
Your Honor, the reason for that is that the identity of the attorney exercising peremptory challenges is not a portion of jury selection that the public trial right attaches to. And the reason for that is the experience and logic test. The court, the defendant, Mr. Navarro, has the burden to satisfy both the logic prong and the experience prong here to show that the identity of the attorney has historically been open to the press and general public, and that the public access to the knowledge of the identity of the attorney exercising the peremptory challenge plays a significant positive role in the functioning of the particular process in question.
Well, we want to know whether the state's being biased and who it's excluding from the jury. That's one reason.
Absolutely. And
don't we want to know who the state's excluding?
And there is a process for that. The nature of peremptory challenges is that there's a party can excuse a juror with no explanation whatsoever. The only possible purpose would be to enlighten the public as to whether one party has used a discriminatory motive behind the peremptory challenge. However, the party who would have the incentive to make that challenge, a Batson challenge, knows the identity of the party. And in the event...
Only the defendant that is interested in making sure the state doesn't discriminate, not the general public?
Well, I think that in... while the general public would have an interest in that, when Batson challenges are made, those are put on the record. And so that would be available to the general public.
We elect a prosecutor in this county. Someone who's deciding who to vote for next time want to know if the prosecutor is supervising attorneys who are exercising discriminatory challenges?
Absolutely. And they would have
How would they know that in this case?
Well, if there were... allegation of discriminatory practices, that would be put on the record. Batson challenges are put on the record in open court.
Facts before you can make challenges, which would mean you need to know what the pattern of exercise of challenges was?
I think that that would be made evident by the challenge that was made. In other words, the party that would have the incentive to bring that to light is aware of what jurors are being excused.
Well, what if the accusation is, well, the prosecutors and the defenders have kind of gotten together on all this and we're discriminating against a minority community?
And that is not the allegation that took place in this case.
No, but I mean, the whole question is, we recognize that the defendant has a right to a public trial. We recognize the public has a right. They're independent. Aren't they entitled to have a complete record? So even if they can't hear it contemporaneously, they can check up on us all.
Well, I don't think that there is any reason to believe that the process here, and including not filing the document on which the peremptories were listed, diminishes the prosecutor's or judge's understanding of their responsibility to the accused. And I think it's also important to note that
this is public's oversight.
Yes, and one of the values of the public trial right is also to have an impartial jury, and this process...
Okay, but what you're doing is you're identifying things that aren't interfered with, but you're not addressing how we further one very important goal, which is the public's ability to oversee and monitor what occurs in the courtroom.
And I'm not aware, Your Honor, of any case where parties... public who weren't present in court then go look to the record, go look to the electronic record.
The first investigative reporter who wants to write the article might be concerned about it.
Now, let's assume that we think it is an important part of the record and that has to be filed, and in this case it isn't. What if there was a key exhibit in the case that was not filed and the clerk lost it? What would the remedy be, and is that the remedy that we should be applying here?
Well, it would, of course, depend on the impact that that had, the actual impact that that had in that particular case. And I think that here, where there was no allegation of discriminatory practices, the fact that it was not filed should not result in the process being considered flawed. I would also note that the core value of the public trial right to create a fair trial The amendments indicate that not only are you right, have a right to a public trial, but a public trial by an impartial jury. And the judge here was focused on making sure that there was no taint to the jury. So in light of that, Your Honor, finally, when drawing all reasonable inferences from the state in a light most favorable to the state, from the state's evidence in a light most favorable to the state, the evidentiary record independent of Navarro's admission supports the logical and reasonable inference that trafficking stolen property occurred. Additionally, the public trial right did not attach the identity of the lawyer exercising the peremptory challenge.
Thank you.
The state would ask that this court affirm Mr. Navarro's conviction. Thank you.
With regard to corpus delicti, counsel urges this court to consider the fact that there was more property taken from the heir's home than was actually found in Mr. Navarro's home, as evidence independent of his statements that, in fact, he had trafficked this property. I would just remind the court that Mr. Navarro did not burglarize the heir's home. I mean, everybody agreed with that. It was another individual. Now, had he been the burglar, maybe the state's argument would hold some water.
Doesn't that suggest that he was trafficking? He might have been purchasing or acquiring?
He certainly had stolen property. That's all we can say. But everybody agrees he was not the person that took
it. Your argument is the burglar may not have sold him everything.
That's correct. Absolutely. And the record just is completely silent on exactly what was provided to Mr. Navarro. In terms of the public trial right, the state argues that the idea of the attorney is not part of jury selection. This is the argument that they continue to make. It was in response to that I cited the supplemental authorities, cases like St. Cali, Gomez v. U.S., Sadler, cases that I think make it clear what the problem is here in keeping from the public which particular attorney is making these peremptory challenges.
Well, what is the problem? The public saw the jurors being dismissed two by two. It saw the defendant interposing no complaint to what was happening. So
the public trial right is not just
what was
just
the public denied?
The public trial right is not just for the defendant. I mean, even if the defendant
that
is not upset,
I understand with that, but the inference is the defendant's got no problem with this.
Because
or the inference is they're all in cahoots together, but you've got the facts that you can draw your inference because you can literally see who's being dismissed.
You can see who's being dismissed, but you can't tell which party is dismissing them. You can't tell if there's a pattern of discrimination.
Well, if it's the defendant who's doing the bad thing by skewing the jury racially, then that's not addressable.
I believe actually it is, Your Honor.
If he was acquitted, we would never summon him back for a new trial.
But the rights under Batson apply equally across the board, regardless of which side is doing
it. But you've got people witnessing what's happening and only two possibilities and knowing what those possibilities are.
And it's important to know then, and not much of a burden, I don't think, on the court, it's important then to know which party
which is what this
is
judge
doing
said was going to happen.
And did not happen.
Didn't do it.
And did not happen. That's
so
correct. And that's key.
How is it different from if the clerk had lost an exhibit? Would it be a court closure?
It depends on the exhibit. In this case, we have a closure because I think there's value in real-time public oversight. It's not fixed by simply...
If the court had lost the lease that affected the property that was issued in the case, would we allow the parties to recreate the content of the lease from other testimony, or would we hold that it was a court closure and structural error and the case had to be retried?
Only you can answer that. I don't
okay.
know, Your Honor. All right. Thank you
I
very much.
Not to have to. Thanks a lot. We're in recess.
All rise. Recess.